Record and live. Thanks for joining me, everyone. Charles Moskowitz, welcome to the program. It's an honor and a privilege to welcome David Stockman. He is former director of the Office of Management and Budget in the Reagan administration, former congressman from Michigan, one of the nation's most respected and revered economists and economic thinkers. Let me just make sure I'm live on. Yep, there we go. Thank you. And he is the author of the new book, The Great Money Bubble: Protect Yourself from the Coming Inflation Storm. David, thanks for joining me.
I'm very happy to be with you. And there is a big storm coming, that's for sure.
We all sense it, and I think it's coming as soon as next year. But before we go there, I just want to ask you about a little anecdote that was sent to me by my math tutor. I'm studying math. In my old age, I'm getting another degree.
Oh, good.
And he said, and math is not my forte, so I have a tutor. And he said to me that when he graduated his math college, his degree,
Yeah.
one of the anecdotes that was stated by his professor was that when you were the director of the Office of Management and Budget, you explained to President Reagan by using the back of a cocktail napkin in a bar how things were going to work by drawing a diagram a graph
Yes.
showing the upward curve associated with maintaining tax rates as they were and how that would result in an increase in revenue in the long run. Is that how that went?
Well, there was a napkin, but it really wasn't drawn by myself. It was drawn by Art Laffer. That's why it's called the Laffer curve.
Oh,
And
okay.
he was basically right. Obviously, if you have government taxes at 80%, the economy is going to weaken because people are going to be not motivated to invest or save or work or, invent or make a new enterprise. So he was right about that. And he's also right that if you had zero rates, you wouldn't get any revenue. The problem was in between, nobody knew for sure where the trade-off would occur from lower growth due to high tax rates as opposed to lower revenue because you were lowering the rate. So that was the great debate of the 1980s. But unfortunately, it led to an easy view in the Republican ranks that all you have to do is cut taxes. The economy will take off like there's no tomorrow, boom and grow. That will make up for the revenue loss and we won't have a deficit problem. But that just proved not to be true. The evidence for that is when I became budget director in 1981, the national debt was 1 trillion. Today it's 31 trillion. And Republicans have been in power almost all the time during that 40-year period. And even during the Clinton era, they actually reduced the deficit quite substantially. So that is kind of part of the background here, which is to say that the great inflation that we're now beginning to experience, 40-year high right now, and it's getting worse, is not something that materialized out of the blue overnight. This thing has been gestating. This thing has been developing since the 1980s. And once we got into the big deficits, because Republicans didn't care and Democrats were big spenders anyway, we were saved only by the fact that the Fed was taken over by Alan Greenspan and he started printing money like there was no tomorrow. Now, what happens when the Fed prints enormous amounts of new credit? Well, what it does is it sops up the debt being issued by the Treasury and keeps the market from suffering, a crowding out effect and higher interest rates from all that Treasury borrowing. The problem is you can't do that forever. Sooner or later, you're going to create so much excess liquidity, so much excess credit, so much speculation in the financial markets that you reach the peak of the bubble, which I think we're at right now, and the Fed is suddenly having to shift gears dramatically and begin to tighten a monetary policy substantially. Now, what does that mean? It means just since March, interest rates have gone from essentially 0 to 4%. That's pretty fast in a short period of time, but that is just a beginning of what's going to be needed to wrestle this double-digit inflation that we have effectively to the ground.
So then we have several decades where you had huge spending on the part of the Democrats. The Republicans kind of turned a blind eye to it mostly, although they used a lot of rhetoric. And the Federal Reserve printing money, which basically means that they are loaning money to their member banks to then basically give people in the form of loans, or in many cases in the 1990s, in the form of social programs, like getting people into housing that maybe would not otherwise qualify. And that results in a weakening of the value of the dollar, because you have more money on the market than the economy is producing. Also, the Federal Reserve is loaning money to the federal government itself at interest, and that interest is a large piece of the annual budget. So you have here a situation where there is too much money in the economy. We are paying interest to the bankers and investors who basically own the Federal Reserve System. And we have an enormous debt, and a lot of our taxes then go toward the maintenance of the debt rather than to actual services. But the practical result is that the value of the dollar for working people has been weakened, because it's not a reflection of the actual value of production as it stands now. So that's what inflation is. So you're saying that we have reached a critical point where the inflated dollar is at that curb, you know, on the cocktail napkin. It sort of reached the moment of where it's no longer going to be sustainable. So the Federal Reserve is reversing course, and they're tightening the money supply. How does that hurt people? And because I know that's a painful, you know, that we get the fact that inflation's painful for working people. When you go to the gas tank and you see that gas is like $5 a gallon, or when you bought the cost of hamburger. But how is the tightening of the interest rates hurting people?
Well, three ways. First of all, interest rates have gone up so much in a short period of time that it's clearly going to have a big effect on the housing market. You know, mortgage rates, long-term 30-year mortgages were under 2%. Not that long ago, 2 years ago, in last week, they were over 7%. And so that there's been a huge boom in the housing market. A lot of people feel that their homes have appreciated substantially, and at least they have that asset. But what we're doing, what we did was we created a second housing bubble this century. We thought we should have learned the lesson in 2007, 2008 when the first Greenspan bubble collapsed. But they were back off to the races again by 2010, 2011, and the Fed was printing money even more aggressively than previously. And if you look at the indices of housing prices, they returned to the 2007 peaks and then went way beyond it. So now we're going to have a pretty serious crash in housing values. Now, that's going to affect a lot of people, even if you're not having to refinance. Even if you're not in the market for the first time for a new mortgage, the value of your underlying asset is going to be reduced substantially. Now, that's unfortunate, but it's also reality. The housing crisis never should have been rising at 20% a year as they have been for the last couple of years.
So they were rising because of the easy dollar, because of the lowering of interest, which, of course, is reflected in the purchase of mortgages. Because when you buy a mortgage, a lot of the money that you spend goes to maintaining the interest. So if you have a lower interest rate, you get a lower payment, so you can afford more. And you can buy what it looks like on paper to be a higher valued home. But I think Alan Greenspan actually wrote a column, I seem to recall, or it might have been Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago, who said that the depression was caused mainly by, among very complex questions, the Federal Reserve overnight raising the interest rate to such an extent as a misguided reaction to such speculation on the market, that it basically it was like a gigantic Mack truck throwing a brake on in a tunnel. I mean, it created like a massive car crash, and that shocked the market to the point where it didn't recover so easily. Isn't that what's going on now?
Well, in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. The issue back with the 1930s and the Great Depression is that that formulation, which Friedman made, was only half the equation. In other words, he should have talked about the tremendous inflation of the mid-20s and late-20s that led to the kind of blow-off top in the stock market in October 1929. In other words, there was so much appreciation, so much speculation in the financial system, including a lot of debt, even for that era, that by the time you reached the peak in 1929, there was nowhere to go except down. And so the Fed, you know, he has argued the Fed should have rescued the economy by printing money. I don't think that would have worked, because that's what Bernanke tried to do in 2008 and 2009. And they say he rescued the economy. But look where we are today. We've had very weak economic growth for the last 10 years, the weakest recovery in modern history. We've had a huge inflation of financial assets, which are now beginning to unwind or beginning to be punctured. And we have an economy that is not serving the interest of the average wage earner, the average saver, the average retiree, all of whom have been hurt badly by this money printing policy we've had for the last couple of decades. Now, the Fed, it doesn't want to do this. You know, they're doing it, kicking and screaming and dragging their feet. But they have said over and over, 2% inflation is our limit, our cap, our target. And if inflation is 8%, in fact, the wholesale inflation last month was 11% year over year, then they're going to throw on the brakes until they can begin to see inflation come back towards 2%. But it's deeply embedded. There's an enormous amount of inflationary momentum, sort of cost push, wage price inflation being built up into the economy. After all, workers do want wage increases because they're behind the curve. For 19 straight months, the inflation rate has exceeded the average gain in wages. And so the average worker is getting further and further and further behind. And so they're going to demand wage increases. But when you have wage increases above what we're getting now, which is about 6%, if they went to 8 or 9%, that's going to be passed through in prices if you're running a restaurant or a gym or something, movie theater even. And so therefore it becomes a spiral. And that's the danger that we're in today. Mm-hmm. It finally got out of control. The Fed is basically panicking. So when you have the all-powerful Federal Reserve panicking, because, you know, they see that the inflation is out of control and it's becoming embedded as a spiral, then you know we're in fairly decent trouble. And we're headed for, I would say, a period of reckoning, which is drastically different than the big party that we've been having for the last decade or two.
Right. And I want to talk a little bit about what average people can do to protect themselves. Your book addresses that very well, the great money bubble. I think that in response to the depression and the complete collapse of virtual collapse of the value of the dollar, the FDR administration and Congress put in some very important and positive guidelines and regulations and ethics rules with regard to how banks and how financial institutions are to conduct themselves and how to separate out some of the investment houses from banks and other things like that. A lot of that was done away with in the 90s during the Clinton administration by Rubin and Summers and some of the libertarian-oriented economic thinkers. I think that Trump tried to bring that back by reducing and getting rid of some of the loopholes that allowed various practices by some of the big hedge funds and things like that. But now with Biden, it's going back to the more libertarian approach. It's basically going back to giving these benefits to the big money combines, which is basically leading to abuse. Do you have any recommendations with regard to the role of government in terms of regulating financial instruments in such a way that investors are protected and that the economy is protected?
Yeah, but I think you have to start at the root cause, and the root cause is the Federal Reserve and the massive amount of liquidity and credit it's injected into the economy. Now, I think there's some solutions to that,
yes.
But I think people ought to be aware that we have been in kind of a fantasy world in terms of the relationship between what I would say the on-the-ground Main Street economy on the one hand and the Wall Street inflated financial asset world on the other. And as a striking illustration or evidence of that, go back to the fall of 2008, when the crisis first hit. And from then until today, the nominal GDP, which is the Main Street economy, is up by 55%. Not very much to write home about, but it's increased by 55%. Then compare, that's the Main Street. Now look at Wall Street as embedded or embodied in the NASDAQ 100. It's up 1,250%, okay? So during the same 13 years, Wall Street has increased 23 times faster than the Main Street economy. Well, that isn't sustainable. That isn't fair. It's created enormous windfalls to the 1% and the 5% that own most of the financial assets. So now getting back to the question, what do you do about that? You have to shut down the printing press. Okay, that's where it starts. You can try to regulate your way around financial bubbles, but let's not create more financial bubbles in the first place, because that's when all the mischief begins. After all, look at what's happened in the last week with FTX. Everybody thought a year ago or 3 years ago, this was the new greatest thing. Cryptocurrencies right. were going to be an alternative to, you know, the manipulated fiat money printed by the Federal Reserve and other banks. But it ended up in such a speculative frenzy that the most grotesque kinds of fraud and manipulation occurred, such that within a 2 week period of time, an entity that people thought was worth $30 billion, or they claimed it was worth $30 billion, turned out to be zero. And if you've seen headlines today, the examiner who's been brought in to reorganize the whatever's left of the mess is a veteran of this workout business. He was the guy who did Enron. Okay, he knows what he's talking about.
Right.
He basically said, I have never seen such an out of control, undisciplined mess in my life, in terms of there were no financial controls, there was no transparency, bank accounts were not reconciled. It was just a huge speculative mess the kind that you might see, you know, in the back streets or something. And that's what, in the end of the day, that FTX bubble crash is a kind of microcosm. It's a poster child for what happens when you have the federal Fed policy of the type that we've had in the last few years.
Right, and they of course were creating cryptocurrency, which is not regulated by anyone, the Fed or the right. federal government. Putting aside the fact that there is a growing political scandal associated with that, and the Democratic yeah. Party receiving huge sums of money to help them with the midterm elections, and kind of a laundering scheme regarding Ukraine. The actual aspect of the non-regulation of those funds hurts average people who think, you know, who don't really know what they're investing in. And, you know, you need to have, this is an area where the federal government or federal agencies need to be involved in helping to regulate financial instruments, because people can't possibly understand what's going on in these things.
I appreciate that point, but I think beyond that, you have to recognize that when it comes to a few regulators attempting to trace all the mischief and the fraud and the abuse and the excess leverage and the reckless risk-taking that can happen out in a financial world where there's millions of tens of millions of players trying to get rich the easy way.
Right.
That it's very difficult for the regulators to keep up if you are basically inflating the bubble at the kind of rate that has been happening over the last couple of years. So I would be happy as a starting point to get back to sound money. And if we got back to sound money in a Federal Reserve that was not trying to prop up the stock market and inject massive amounts of liquidity to make it easy for speculators, of course, they don't admit that's what they're doing, but that's really what they're doing. If we at least stop that aspect, then the natural prudence of people would come back and at least there would be competition. In other words, things get out of control when it's a one-way street, when nobody's short, when nobody's selling, when the skeptics have been carried off the field because they have been wrong time after time. You have to get back to two-way markets. You have to get back to a situation where a short seller will sniff around and do some homework and do some digging and find out FTX is a fraud. And you could have figured that out because the, it's transparent. Cryptos and the blockchain is transparent. Mm-hmm. You could have found all those transactions.
Yeah, plus so, a lot of people are on the take, putting that aside.
But now it's all coming out. There's all kinds of, researchers and investigators putting out tons of information to show what was happening there all along. But as long as everything was inflating and going up, no one listened to them. And now there's a lot of very hurt people. There's billions and billions of deposits.
This could be the biggest scandal since Madoff and since Enron and all of the rest. It's huge and growing. You say that you want to see the Federal Reserve stop the printing presses. You want to see them stop the printing of easy money. Doesn't this get into a more fundamental question about the system we have? The Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, says that Congress shall regulate the value of the dollar. They regulate the coin and the value thereof. Not the Federal Reserve, which is a private, semi-public consortium of banks and investors.
Right.
But yet we need a Federal Reserve in that I think we need to have a separate money authority that's not going to fall under the complete control of the government either, which might decide to, they'll turn on the printing press. They'll set up a printing press in the Capitol building. I mean, it's not, right? So it's a complicated question. Is there a way that the Federal Reserve can be somehow reined in, brought a little bit more under the direct control of Congress, our elected representatives, while at the same time maintaining a certain wall of separation so that Congress can't simply go in and start dipping their hand in the cookie jar?
Yeah, great question. And in fact, there is a clean, clear answer. And that, ironically, is go back to the concept that the author of the Federal Reserve Act, Carter Glass, he was chairman of the Banking Committee in the House during 1913 when they passed the legislation. He shepherded it through. And he was very anti-Wall Street. And his whole theme was it was to be a banker's bank, decentralized in 12 regional authorities, that would operate a discount window that bankers would come to with good collateral and pay a penalty rate of interest if they wanted to borrow money in order to fund their loan books, fund their operations. Now, the key thing about the banker's bank is that it had no macroeconomic role. It had no macroeconomic remit. It wasn't supposed to target interest rates or GDP growth or unemployment or housing starts or anything else. It was a passive authority available to provide liquidity to the banking system as driven by Main Street commerce, Main Street banks, Main Street businesses, manufacturers, and so forth. And if you did that and not had what we have today, which is basically monetary central planning by 12 people who sit on the open market committee, you would have a much more workable system. It would be self-correcting. because if there was too much demand for credit at any given time, interest rates would rise substantially because the Fed wouldn't be in charge of pegging interest rates. When interest rates started to rise substantially, it would be less attractive to borrow money. And so, you know, demand for funds and debt would cool down, abate, and the system would constantly regulate itself, and you wouldn't get into these massive bubbles that cannot be resolved except through a crash. And that's where we are today. So the short answer is go back to Carter Glass, who everybody's familiar with him as the author of the Glass-Steagall Act.
Glass-Steagall, which separated
the... That was in the 30s during the New Deal. But he, long before that, he had set up the Fed in a good manner that was then abandoned very quickly thereafter when in World War I, Wilson, who was nuts as far as I'm concerned, decided they're going to finance the war by printing money at the Fed. And that actually started, you know, the Federal Reserve down the road of owning $31 billion.
It became like a centralized, nationalized entity. And you're suggesting a decentralized bank, which the regional banks would be concomitant to, with the economies that they were operating in and the needs of those economies. It goes back in American history to the Massachusetts, where I am, the Massachusetts Bay Colony setting up a land bank that, that loaned money at very low interest rates to local farmers and businessmen, and who people qualified for the loan. They took the risk. It was very conservative. And they would take the interest and they would use it to pay for things like lamps in Beacon Hill here in Boston, which are still here. So, I mean, this is like a model that Massachusetts kind of like led the way in terms of the way banking or central banking should work. David, I want to ask you, because we're reaching toward the end of the program, what are your practical recommendations for average people listening, people like myself, people who are, you know, they're not rolling in dough? What can we do with this coming crash that you're talking about and that I think everyone understands is coming down the pike?
Well, the first thing is to recognize the circumstances we're in, that we're going to go through a huge change of direction, that after 30 years of constantly rising markets where, you know, you could double, triple, quadruple your money if you picked the right stock or the right asset class or even the right crypto, that's all gone. And so therefore, the whole idea of your net worth, of your wealth, is actually a function of both your assets and your liabilities. And we're in the era now, we're in a new era where the focus has to be on liabilities, not on assets, because assets are not going to keep going up. They're going to actually deflate. I think we're going to have a big deflation of real estate assets, of stocks, and even longer term treasuries, unless you hold them to maturity, are going to drop in value as interest rates go up. Okay. So people need to focus on, how do I reduce my debt? Well, if you've got some real winners from the stock market that rode this bubble to the top, would be a good time to liquefy those winners and pay down some debt. That's one thing to do. Okay. Second, if you developed a living standard based on, you know, a rising financial asset returns, it would be a good time to start cutting back on spending a little bit and using the cash to pay down debt. After all, reducing the liabilities will raise net worth as effectively as appreciating the assets. And we're not in an environment now where asset appreciation is, for the most part, a very available opportunity. Now, the other thing you can do is hedge. And I talk in there about the one thing that I think will ride out the storm, this inflationary storm and this big correction that's coming, is gold, because gold is the original money.
Yes,
and it was, it was abandoned by Nixon in 1971, and it's a whole complicated, arcane story about how you really want something, some hard asset backing your financial system. But in any event, I think it's very likely that gold will hold its value and most likely appreciate considerably as we get into this deeper and deeper and more difficult storm. So Those are the things: reduce liabilities, reduce spending, hedge your portfolio. There's obviously more to it, but those are the headlines.
Okay, excellent. David A. Stockman is my guest. The book is The Great Money Bubble: Protect Yourself from the Coming Inflation Storm. David, where can people get your excellent book?
The quickest way to get it is on Amazon. It's readily available. I think you can get it delivered right away. That's the short answer.
Okay. Is there any website you'd like to mention?
Yeah, I do publish a daily newsletter that covers all of these topics on a current basis based on, you know, developments as they occur day to day, week to week. It's called David Stockman's Contra Corner. And you can Google David Stockman's Contra Corner and click on to how you sign up.
And what do you think about the Republicans taking over Congress in January?
Well, you know, my two or three votes is better than not taking over, okay. But it's going to be like a paralysis on steroids for the next 2 years,
okay.
Which in some ways is a good thing. If Washington is not doing anything, at least we're not worse off.
That's right. It's always good news. Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, David. Listen, it's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.